Krishna will take care of. It's like there was one in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, there's an example of one of the cowherd boys. He was fanning Krishna with the chamara.
It was a hot day.
Actually, yeah. And as he was fanning Krishna, he was looking at Krishna, and Krishna was revealing such beauty to him that he was crying in ecstasy. He was just crying in such love. And his limbs were shaking in ecstasy. But it was disturbing how nicely he could fan Krishna. So he began to curse these ecstasies. And he was praying to Krishna to take them away because they were interfering with how he could serve Krishna. Huh? So we should not be so much concerned with what we are feeling. We should be concerned with how we are pleasing Krishna and Guru. Huh?
This question I asked Maharaj because I heard one cassette. It was verse written by Kaikari Maharaj. And he says in his verse, I am getting that smell of which is made up of chandan. What we say chandan?
Sandalwood.
So I am getting a smell like sandalwood. And it is, I am sure it is coming from Vitthal himself, because Vitthal is made up of sandalwood himself. And that smell I am getting. So then, when I listened to that, then I was wondering whether this is this various ways Krishna reveals himself by good smell, like that.
Krishna is infinite. He can reveal himself in infinite ways. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to say, do not try to see Krishna, but try to serve Krishna in such a way that he wants to see you. Do not try to enjoy Krishna, but try to serve Krishna in such a way that he is enjoying you. Bhakti Vinod Thakur prays that my Lord, the inconveniences and sufferings that I undergo in your service, those experiences are my greatest pleasures in life. Huh? We are not so much concerned with experiencing as being experienced by Krishna. He is not meant for our pleasure, we are meant for his pleasure. Huh?
I've been told since from my childhood by my father that those who are in devotional path, they are always blissful. Not blissful. It is if they are in disease, that means they are not washed off their karma yet. The disease or in difficulties, they are, how can they be a pure devotee?
Hmm. Sanatana Goswami, he was one of the Manjaris, one of the gopis of Vrindavan. For one full year, his body was covered with excruciating diseases. Correct? Vasudeva, the leper, he was one of the greatest devotees in the whole universe. He spent his whole life in leprosy. You cannot, in Rupa Goswami, in the Nectar of Devotion, he explains that when a great devotee, you cannot judge him by material conditions. He says even if the great devotee is disfigured, suffering from great diseases, he said, it is like bubbles, it is like foaming bubbles in the water of the Ganges. The Ganges is always pure. But sometimes to our vision it does not appear pure. But is the Ganges ever impure? To a materialist it is, but to a devotee it cannot be. Huh? Jesus Christ was a great devotee. Was he blissful when he was being tortured? Huh? Internally, he may be blissful. But the material body is the material body. Prabhupada got 3 heart attacks. Huh? You cannot judge a great devotee by his material conditions. You can only judge a great devotee by the quality of his actions and his consciousness. A person under all circumstances never leaves the lotus feet of Krishna. That is the sign of a great devotee. Yes, of course. To the degree we are attached to the material body, we are very affected. Depends on the particular level of consciousness of the devotee. Suffering is meant for our purification. Suffering is the greatest opportunity to come close to Krishna if we take advantage of it. Huh? For a devotee. Queen Kunti prayed for suffering. Because in those sufferings, how much she was desperately crying out for Krishna. When everything is very nice, how casually we take Krishna consciousness for granted. Huh? So therefore, Krishna gives suffering to his devotee to intensify his devotee's devotion. That is for a neophyte devotee. Also for his purification. A neophyte devotee, he may deserve so much suffering due to his previous karma, but Krishna minimizes it just to a very small amount, just so that devotee can understand what his sinful activities have been, and so he becomes more serious to rectify himself. Huh? So that is for his purification. Now advanced devotees, their suffering is sometimes offered by the Lord to show the world how even in the face of the greatest adversary, the great devotees never give up the devotion of the Lord, never give up showing compassion to others. Huh? And very, very great devotees, they suffer because they're accepting the sufferings of others. The spiritual master takes all the karma of his disciples. And sometimes Krishna, just to make the disciples serious, puts the spiritual master in suffering conditions, knowing that it's due to their lack of Krishna consciousness that they're making their guru suffer. No? Because that's what it takes to make them serious. And the guru is so kind, he's willing to accept that position. So according to the different levels of elevation in devotional service, there's a different reason why we suffer. But there will be. In the material level, suffering and happiness are two sides of the same coin. We should not be concerned with whether we are suffering or not suffering. We should simply be concerned with our service, how we are pleasing Krishna. Huh? If our suffering, if remaining fixed in our service during times of great trial and tribulation, if that is pleasing to Krishna, that is our happiness. Huh? And if Krishna puts us in a situation of great prosperity in serving Him in that condition, that also gives Him great pleasure. We should be concerned with the service, not with how we feel. Matras parashastukomte yashitoshnashupadukata. Krishna says the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress, they appear like the winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception only. One should learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. What does that mean? That means forget about your happiness and distress. Tolerate both. Tolerate your happiness and tolerate your distress. If you enjoy your happiness, then you will suffer your distress. Right? If you tolerate happiness, you will also be able to tolerate distress. That means our consciousness should not be concerned with our own happiness and distress. Our consciousness should be concerned with how we are executing the desire of God, how we are pleasing Krishna. That should be our only standard of happiness. If Krishna's happy, I'm happy. Even if I'm in the most miserable condition, or even if I'm in the most happy condition. Doesn't matter. If Krishna's happy, I'm happy. Right? And if Krishna's unhappy, I'm unhappy. Despite my material situation. We should develop this consciousness. What is the position of a servant? To give pleasure to the master. The servant cannot be concerned with his own pleasure. Right? The servant must be concerned with the master. Sometimes the servant has to do very, very difficult things for the master. Does he consider that I don't like this, I like this? Huh? He simply considers whether the master likes. When a mother is taking care of a child, does the mother consider, do I like doing this? Huh? Is that your consideration? I like rising in the middle of the night to change my baby's clothes. Does she like that? Does she consider I like or I do not like? She doesn't consider these things. She does it because she loves the child, because she's a servant of the child. Huh? How much more is our relationship with God? We are His servant. Forget what you like or don't like. Forget what makes you happy or not happy. As long as you're attached to that, you must suffer. Huh? To the degree you're attached to being happy, to that degree you must suffer. That is why Prahlad said, if you want to be happy in this world, there's only one way. And that is, stop trying to be happy. As long as you're trying to be happy in this world, you have to suffer. As soon as you give up the desire to be happy in this world, then there's no more suffering. There's no such thing as suffering. Huh? And how do you give up the desire to be happy in this world? Not by just voiding out all our desires, but by making our goal of life Krishna's happiness. Huh? It's like a parent. Even if the parent has to go through such great hardships, if they see the child is happy, isn't that the parent's happiness? Huh? Isn't that love? How much more for Krishna? That is why, to the bhaktas, even the pursuit of mukti is considered not at all desirable. Because why does a person want mukti? A person wants mukti because a person is tired of suffering. Mukti means no more suffering. Correct? Mukti is that state of consciousness where you are beyond the three modes of material nature, where you no longer have to suffer happiness or distress. But you're still considering, you're striving for it because you want to be free from suffering. You want to experience that divine state. Huh? The devotee does not care for that divine state. A devotee simply wants to please Krishna. To a bhakta, the pursuit of mukti is selfish. We're thinking in terms of my own relief. There is a story of gopis. Krishna had headache, and he asked his friend Uddhava that the only way I will be free from this very painful headache is if the dust of the feet of my devotees is applied to my head. So Uddhava was first sent to the forest where the great sages were doing the sacrifice. And he said, Krishna has headache, he wants dust from your feet, and that will make him feel better. And they said, no, how is this possible? Krishna is God. If we put the dust from our feet on his head, we will go to hell. That's a very suffering condition. So they refused. And Uddhava was thinking, very nice. I mean, how could they put their feet on Krishna's head? But still, he had to carry out Krishna's mission. So then he was sent to the ashram where the great jnanis were studying the Shastra very scrutinizingly. They said, Lord Sri Krishna has headache, he wants the dust from your feet on his head, that will make him feel better. They said, Krishna, he is the Supreme Brahman. He is the one that is being spoke of in all the Upanishads. If we put the feet of our bodies on his head, this will be such an offense. We will go to hell. How could we even consider this? Tell Krishna it is not possible. So Krishna said to Uddhava, he said, that's very nice, but I still have my headache. Everyone is very concerned with not going to hell, but I still have my headache. So maybe you should go to Vrindavan, ask the gopis. So he asked gopis, Krishna wants, if you put your dust on Krishna's head, you will go to hell, but he wants your dust for his headache. So they immediately started collecting all particles of dust from their feet and putting them in nice containers and told Uddhava, run, go fast, bring this to Krishna. Uddhava was very surprised. How is this possible? They're taking the dirt from their feet and they're sending it for Krishna's head? He said, gopis, don't you know you will go to hell? And the gopis, they were just saying, just go, go, go. Don't worry about us going to hell. They said, if it takes going to hell for the rest of eternity to relieve Krishna of his headache, that is our greatest pleasure. This is love. Savai pung som puro dharamo yato bhakti radhokshaje ahoy taki aprati hata jujatma supersede. The supreme occupation for all humanity is that which brings one to the loving service of the Lord. Such service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. What does it mean to be unmotivated? That means no desire for happiness or distress, pleasure or pain. No consideration of ourselves, simply a consideration of our beloved. That is bhakti. Of course, we cannot artificially pretend to be like that, but we should understand that that is the goal and we should strive for that. And in our present condition of consciousness, how to strive for that? By simply making the desire of our Guru and the desire of Krishna our life and soul. And not be concerned with our own like or dislike. We have to tolerate these things. Huh? You are a doctor. Sometimes you're called in the middle of the night for a patient. Do you like this? But it is your service to the patient. A good doctor has no consideration of his own comforts. His only consideration is what is best for the patient. Correct? Is that the good doctor? And you're doing that just for some money. And what is that money compared to the mercy of God? How much more you should be like that for Krishna and your Guru and the devotees? Huh? By getting one speck of the blessings of the great souls, that is more valuable than all the money in the entire creation. Huh? Because the blessing of the great souls and the mercy of Krishna is eternal. It's inexhaustible. You get some money and it's here today and tomorrow it's gone. Huh? So just for some money, we're willing to put aside our own likes or dislikes, tolerate all these things to serve another. Huh? How much more so we should be willing to have that consciousness for the eternal blessings of God, in the eternal service of the great souls. That person is sincere, he can humbly present his suggestion, but then accept whatever the higher authorities decide. We should not be attached to our ideas. After all, Arjuna had good suggestions to Krishna also, did he not? In the first chapter of the Gita, Arjuna was presenting so many suggestions to Krishna why he should not fight. Many logical arguments he had. Huh? But then in the end he said, okay Krishna, I have spoken, now what do you want? And Krishna told him, fight. Krishna told him exactly the opposite of everything Arjuna was inclined toward. And Arjuna accepted. So there is no harm in humbly presenting our ideas and our feelings. But surrender means to ultimately accept the verdict of the higher authorities. We should not be attached to our ideas. We should be attached to Krishna's desire.
How do you know like what the higher authorities are desiring is Krishna's desire?
How do you know?
stomachs and your toes and feel it.
If you have a spiritual master, you ask, should I follow this person or not? If he says yes, then you must accept. It's very simple. You simply inquire. Otherwise, there's no question of surrender. As long as you're always evaluating whether my higher authority has Krishna in mind or not, whether my higher authority is doing what Krishna wants or not, then you'll always choose those things that you like and reject those things that you don't like, which means no surrender. That means you're insincere. Therefore, it is not our position to be evaluating. If he tells us to break the regulative principles, if he tells us to specifically go against the order of the spiritual master, then we can reject with the blessings of the spiritual master. But if it's simply a question of serving this way or serving that way, we must accept. It is not our position to evaluate. What is our level of spiritual advancement that we can question whether this is what Krishna wants or not? Huh? What Krishna wants is for us to be the servant of the servant of the servant. That's what he wants. Even if the details are wrong, even just like Srila Prabhupada used to tell us, even if I'm wrong, I'm right. Huh? What does that mean? Prabhupada used to say that, even if I'm wrong, I'm right. Which means even by the material standard of the details, even if I'm completely wrong, as far as you're concerned, I'm right, because it is the desire of Krishna. Our position is to be the servant of the servant. We are not so concerned with the material details. Oftentimes the spiritual master directly tests his disciples in this way. One time Srila Prabhupada was mailing a delivery, and it was an important delivery, and Prabhupada wrapped it in a certain way. And it was wrapped in a certain way that it was obviously going to fall to pieces in the mail. So the devotee said, Prabhupada, this is going to fall to pieces in the mail. I want to repack it. And Prabhupada said, no, you leave it as it is and mail it. So the devotee was thinking that Prabhupada doesn't understand it's going to fall to pieces, so he repacked it. And Prabhupada became very angry with him. For his own spiritual benefit. This is when he said, even if the spiritual master is wrong, he's right. He said, you cannot be judging the spiritual master by your material conceptions of what is, according to this world, right or wrong. Huh? Prabhupada told us, if the spiritual master says a rope is a snake, you have to say, yes, it is a snake. And it is only due to my defect of material vision that I am seeing a rope. Right? Now you might think that's crazy, blind faith. But it's not. If he tells you something that's not what Krishna says, then he's not a guru. But he has to take you beyond your attachments to worldly perceptions. Because as long as you're attached to worldly perceptions, you can never understand Krishna. Impossible. You can never understand Krishna through sense perception. You can never understand Krishna through material logic or reasoning. You have to transcend all these things. You can only understand Krishna through faith. through faith in higher power of God. So what's right is surrender, and what's wrong is not to surrender. That's our only consideration. We're not concerned with whether something materially falls apart or not. We're concerned with whether we surrender or not surrender. That's right or wrong, from the spiritual level. We do not make... If making spiritual advancement was attained by manipulating matter in the proper way, then, my God, the demons would be the best devotees in the world. Because they're building huge cities, they're building wonderful computers, right? They do everything just right from that point of view. But because they're not surrendered, they're making no spiritual advance. But if you're doing for God, that means you're surrendering to God. What does it mean to do it for God? Krishna told Arjuna to kill Radheya when he was unarmed, off his chariot, with both of his hands pulling his chariot wheel out of the mud. Huh? Now, according to the laws of a Kshatriya, it was completely sinful what Arjuna did, right? And Arjuna did not want to do it. He knew it would ruin his reputation like anything as a Kshatriya forever. It would forever be a blemish on his reputation of the Kshatriya, but it would forever glorify his name as a devotee. So the devotees love Arjuna for doing it, but the Kshatriya say he made a mistake. Right? Similarly, Yudhisthira, when Drona was creating such havoc on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, the only way to stop him was to tell a lie. The only way to stop him from completely destroying the entire Pandava army is someone had to tell him that his son was dead. Because he was on fire with anger. He was like a raging fire. He was consuming. He did more damage than even Bhishma. He was killing tens and thousands at a moment. And even Arjuna could not even stand before him when he was in this wrath. So Bhima went. Bhima wasn't so concerned with lying or not lying. Bhima just wanted to do whatever was necessary. Bhima went and told him, Ashwatthama, your son is dead. And Drona, at first, he practically fainted. And then he came to his senses. And he said, I can't believe Ashwatthama. He has a benediction. He cannot be killed. There's no possibility that he's dead. So then he started fighting again. He didn't believe Bhima. Now, Yudhisthira never even considered a lie in his mind from the day of his birth. And everyone knew that when Yudhisthira spoke, it was the truth under all circumstances. And Drona had this respect for Yudhisthira. So Krishna told Yudhisthira Maharaj that the only way to save your army is you have to tell Drona that his son is dead. And Yudhisthira said to Krishna, I have never lied in my life. This will ruin my whole... as the supreme embodiment of truth and dharma, this will ruin my whole reputation. Krishna said, lie. Huh? But because he was somewhat attached to truth, Bhima, he was such a glorious person. He went right in the Pandava army, and it was an elephant named Ashwatthama, and Bhima just smashed him in the head and killed him. And he said, so the elephant Ashwatthama is dead, so now you're not exactly lying. So then Yudhisthira approached Drona. He went to his chariot. And Drona knew that if what Yudhisthira speaks is the truth. And he said, Yudhisthira Maharaj, if you tell me this, I must accept. And Yudhisthira said, Ashwatthama is dead. And then he said, Ashwatthama the elephant. But he said it softly, and when he said the elephant, Krishna blew his conch shell, so Drona could not hear the elephant word. So in this way, Drona became very disheartened and lost all his desire to fight. Now, to this day in India, more than half the people of India that I talk to, they criticize Yudhisthira for lying. Huh? They say Yudhisthira ruined all of his moral principles by telling a lie. And Krishna was not correct by telling him to lie. But the devotees, they consider that was the most glorious thing in all of Yudhisthira's life. Huh? The devotees consider that moment the most glorious moment in Yudhisthira's life. And the worldly moralists, they consider it the absolutely most distasteful blemish in all of Yudhisthira's life. Because from the material point of view, it was sinful. But from the spiritual point of view, he abandoned all varieties of religion and he surrendered. So was he right or wrong? To a materialist he was wrong, to a devotee he was right. Huh? So we make spiritual advancement not by satisfying the materialist, but by satisfying the spiritual master in Krishna. Right? And the only way we satisfy them is by surrender. Pariprashnena sevaya, by inquiring submissively and rendering service. That is how we please the Guru and Krishna. So it is our duty, if we have a certain project, that we must inform our authorities of the data that is required. But in the end, the data means nothing. It's only the surrender that means something. Huh? So do not be attached to the data. Be attached to the surrender. It is your service to present it, but ultimately it is your service to accept. Sometimes the spiritual master purposely, explicitly, tells you something that's totally wrong by all material standards, just to give you the opportunity to surrender beyond your own mental conceptions. Huh? If you're not willing to do that, you're not the servant. That is the test of our sincerity.
But if it means to, for the person to lose the faith in higher authorities, in that case, what should you do?
What's the question of losing faith? He doesn't have any faith. There's nothing to be lost. Faith means acceptance of a reality beyond our own mental and sensual perception. Huh? Faith means beyond what we can perceive. That is why generally in our sampradaya, the great devotees will never perform miracles. Never. The reason is these miracles convince you on the basis of what you can perceive with your senses. But higher than that is to convince you through hearing, through sound vibration, to create faith beyond what you can see. Because as long as your faith is established by what you can see with your own senses, then your faith always remains on the material platform. And ultimately you have to go beyond your sense perception to understand God. Even Lord Jesus Christ, he performed so many miracles. And he himself said this was for the less intelligent. When he went to one village and he spoke and they accepted his words without him performing miracles, he said, "These are the best people. I didn't have to do this. They accepted my words." So the great souls, they do not convince you by showing miracles. They convince you by speaking the truth. And that truth takes you to a platform where you have faith in something beyond your sense perception. And God is beyond your sense perception. Factually, what the scientists say in many cases will completely contradict what the Vedas say. Huh? But science is always changing. The Vedas said 5,000 years ago the world was round. But up until 500 years ago, all scientists in the West considered the world was flat. Until Magellan went around the world, they were not convinced that the world was round. So the Vedas always said, but science is always changing. Science has so many theories about the planets, about the universe, about astrology. And Prabhupada, he specifically would just be so strong to just keep preaching over and over and over again something that the Vedas said that contradicted all Western science. Devotees would think, why is he just emphasized like that? He would say the moon is farther than the sun, according to the Vedas. Now, according to the scientists, it's completely wrong. But in practically every one of Prabhupada's books and so many lectures, he repeats this. Why does he keep repeating it? It's the most controversial thing he ever said. Hundreds of devotees left our movement because he said this. It's a fact. Hundreds. They left our movement because they said, this is wrong. We cannot accept it. And Prabhupada said, whether the sun is closer or the moon is closer is not important. What is important is that you have faith in the scriptures more than the scientists. Huh?
Eliminated those who are less sincere.
That's exactly what he did. Can your faith in the scientists ever give you an understanding of God? But your faith in the scriptures can. They are perceiving everything with their eyes, with their gross minds and with their gross eyes. And they're coming to certain conclusions. But you can never, ever, ever, ever in a million billion lifetimes ever perceive God with your gross eyes and your gross minds. Premanjana Churita Bhakti Vilochanena. It is said that you can only perceive Krishna when your eyes are decorated with the ointment of divinity, of love. When Krishna wanted to show Arjuna the universal form, he said, first I must give you divine eyes. You cannot see spirit with material vision. You can only see spirit when God reveals that spirit to you. Huh? So the scientists, their conception of what is real and what is true is what they figure out with their gross senses and their gross minds. Right? So they have one conception of reality. But a devotee has a totally different idea of reality. He considers it completely unimportant what the gross mind and senses tell us, because all we could undo is understand the temporary things which are all dying. To understand what is life, you have to go beyond the senses. Therefore, you have to put your faith in what is beyond, in the word of God, not in the word of the materialist. Huh? If you're not willing to do that, you'll never, ever, ever see God. After all, it says in the scripture that Krishna had 16,108 palaces. And Dwarka was just a little island. So how will so many hundreds of millions of people fit on such a little island? It's not possible. Huh? So people say it's not true. This is all mythology. How is it true? Why does the Vedas talk like this? Why did Krishna reveal it like that? He specifically did it just to bewilder the materialists. If Krishna wants to put 10 billion people on the head of a needle, he can put 10 billion people on the head of the needle, and they will all have nice homes with plenty of room to grow their own food and everything. Huh? Is that possible? According to the scientists, it's impossible. But according to the devotees, it's fully possible. Because Krishna is a Chintya Shakti. He's inconceivable. If you do not accept Krishna's inconceivable nature, you cannot understand Krishna. And inconceivable means you have to accept with faith, not by your material senses. So it is the duty of the great souls to shake loose our attachment to material reasoning. And place our faith in what is beyond.
You said what the spiritual master says is true. When the impersonal is within the, they don't deform the God. So the followers, they are following what is, that's a faith. They're just following the master, spiritual master. Now how do we know we are following the right spiritual master?
Spiritual master is Krishna. And one who repeats Krishna is his representative. Krishna is Jagat Guru. He is the supreme guru. And the bona fide spiritual master, he is simply repeating what Krishna has said. He is not adding, he is not subtracting, he is simply delivering the message. So Krishna has revealed his divine form. He has explained in the Gita, in the Bhagavat, in the Ishopanishad, many of the Shastras, that he has an impersonal form, he has an impersonal existence, he has a personal form, he is both. But of the two, the personal form, he explains, is more inclusive, it is higher. You cannot love the impersonal. Bhakti or love is the highest realization of God. Love can only be an exchange between the Jivatma and the Paramatma. In the condition of mukti, there is no loving exchange. There is simply eternal existence, which is one aspect of Krishna, but it is not the full sublime aspect of Krishna. So therefore, one who Krishna says, abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender to me. So the guru who is teaching the highest level of consciousness is he who is teaching that, abandon all varieties of religion and surrender to Krishna. So there may be gurus in the school of impersonal, and there is gurus in the school of personal, and they are both teaching different levels of the absolute truth. And they may both be bona fide according to that particular level of consciousness that is being strived for. But we should understand what is the highest realization and how to attain it. Krishna says, Bhaktya mam abhijanati yavan yashta smitatvata tatomam tatavro dhyatva vishite tar anantaram. Only by pure devotion can one understand me as I am, standing before you. It means that they can eventually, but not until they graduate beyond that particular school of realization. There is three realizations, Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. If you realize Brahman, it doesn't mean you cannot realize Bhagavan, but you have to graduate from that realization to Paramatma and Bhagavan. It's a very long process. Bahunam janmanamante jnanapamam papadyate vasudeva sarvamiti samahatma sudurla. Krishna says after many births and deaths of practicing the various religions, when one finally comes to the platform of knowledge, he surrenders to me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is.
So we must have all in the past life gone through all these things, possibly finally.
Very likely you have. generally for a person to come to the path of bhakti, he's already gone through all the processes of karma, jnana, astanga, all these other yoga systems, until he finally comes to that platform of surrendering to Krishna. But sometimes, simply by the causeless mercy of a pure devotee, one is immediately elevated to this position, even with no previous qualifications. But either way, it doesn't make any difference. If we accept that mercy, whether we're qualified or unqualified, we become qualified. The only qualification is we simply accept the causeless mercy of Krishna coming through the great souls. That is the only qualification required.
Isn't it difficult for a Christian to come into this?
But Jesus taught bhakti. Jesus taught the path of bhakti. Jesus taught the path of devotion. But he was simply giving a more preliminary understanding of the nature of God. But the basic principle is the same. That it is only through love, it is only through faith, it is only through devotion that you can approach the Lord. Huh? That is between him and Jesus. That is not for us to judge. If he is surrendering to his guru, then he is on the path of devotion. And we should not judge what realization Krishna will decide. Huh? Of course, our Guru Maharaj Srila Prabhupada told us that those who are pure Christians, they go to Satyaloka, where Jesus resides. And there Jesus will continue giving them more information of Krishna. And ultimately they will go back to Goloka Vrindavan. Huh? Satyaloka? Satyaloka is a very divine planet within this world. Not within this world, but within this universe.
Krishna, they asked Christ that he multiplied all the fishes and all the things they wanted to eat. How can he ask them to eat fish? Even if his preliminary knowledge he was giving them.
That is why the Vedas, the great acharyas, they explain that the Bible and the Quran is specifically scriptures meant for Malechas and Yavanas. This is not a criticism, this is actually the great mercy of these souls, that they're willing to preach to such people. Look at the culture of those people. They were all barbarians practically. They practically had no real sense of religion. So therefore, this was a completely meat-eating society. By Vedic standards, a completely uncivilized society. To try to bring them closer to God. That was the mission of these great souls. So they did not emphasize many details. They let them go on their own way in certain ways, but they tried to bring them to a higher platform of faith and devotion to their guru and to God. The Vedas also, the Markandeya Purana recommends that you offer goats to Goddess Kali and eat it. Recommends it. Even says Kali is supreme. Huh? So what does that mean? I mean, for that class of people, you just have to somehow or other get them to take to a process by which they can become more advanced. We cannot expect everyone to come to the highest level. So at that time, everyone was eating like this. So therefore, Jesus was not so much emphasizing vegetarianism. Although it's also there in the Bible. There are many sects, there are many monasteries of Christians who never touch meat. They know it's better to not do. In America, every Friday, all Christians were not allowed to eat any meat. All Catholics. Up until some years ago, they stopped that. When I was a child, restaurants would never serve meat on Friday because it was against the laws of Catholicism. But then the Vatican said people are leaving our church because of this. So therefore they said, okay, you can eat meat on Fridays, no problem. And everyone knew the reason why is that it's not good to eat meat at all. So at least one day a meat abstain. What? At least one day a week. But now they can't even do it one day a week. Also, they were living in a desert on the sea. So what do you eat if you're on the desert and the sea? Fish was practically their whole livelihood. It was practically the only thing there was. Huh? So under those circumstances, if there's nothing else, it's not simple to eat. So taking all these things into consideration, we should not be so concerned with Jesus. Was giving fish.
So what was so special for Arjuna? That is, we don't see any of this. Is it like externally we don't see anything, but he was surrendered to God, the stream? We don't see any of this devotional. As Arjuna says, we look at him as a Kshatriya.
A devotee doesn't see Arjuna so much as a Kshatriya. A devotee sees Arjuna for his surrender. As a Kshatriya, he did a lot of things. Do you know how he killed Jayadratha? In a few days, in a few weeks, on Mahabharata, you will see. He cheated. He did not have the power to kill Jayadratha. He made a vow that by sunrise tomorrow I will kill Jayadratha.
Sunset.
And the sun was about to set. And there was no chance of him killing Jayadratha. Because everyone was around Jayadratha defending him. And Jayadratha was defending himself. There was no time, there was only seconds to go till the sunset. And Arjuna realized it's not possible. And Krishna also realized that it's impossible for Arjuna to do it. Now, what would be the honorable thing for Arjuna to do? To just admit, I cannot do it and enter into fire. Right? That would be the honorable Kshatriya thing to do. Correct? But what did Arjuna do? Krishna took his Sudarshan Chakra and blocked the sun. So everyone thought the sun set. And then all the devotees, all the Kurus got off the chariots and started saying, ah, Haribo, Arjuna has to go into fire. And Jayadratha put down his weapons and looked up toward the sun. And he was looking the other way and he saw that the sun had set and he was feeling great relief. And then Krishna told Arjuna, you take your crescent arrow, your Pashupat weapon, and you cut off his head now. And Arjuna took his Pashupat crescent-shaped arrow and sliced off his head. And then Krishna said, do not let his head touch the ground. But take another arrow and send his head to where his father is sitting. So it fell on his father's lap. And Arjuna, Krishna said, I'll tell you about it later. You just do it now. He did it. And then when everyone saw the Jayadratha was killed by Arjuna after the sunset, they were completely disgusted with him. Absolutely disgusted. They were thinking, as a Kshatriya, he's the lowest on earth. Look at what he has done. And then Krishna removed the Sudarshan chakra, and the sun appeared for about a few seconds, and then it set. And then they realized that it never set. But it was all a trick. Huh? He killed Jayadratha when Jayadratha was completely unarmed and looking at this and looking into the sky. Does a Kshatriya ever kill a man like that in battlefield? It's against all the codes of combat. Now these incidents are the most glorified activities of Arjuna for the devotees. We relish this pastime more than when Arjuna was killing everybody fair and square. Huh? Because when he was killing everybody fair and square, that was his own ability. But this was the proof of his unmotivated surrender to Krishna. He was even willing to surrender his own name and fame. And not only that, but after Krishna left the planet, Arjuna became a worthless little warrior. He went to Dwarka and he tried to protect Krishna's queens, and a band of cowherd men defeated him in battle. You know that? Arjuna lost to some band of simple cowherd men. They attacked Arjuna. Here Arjuna's fighting with, he killed Bhishma, he killed Karna, he killed the greatest warriors on earth, and he couldn't even fight against these simple men. And Arjuna realized, after Krishna left the world, Krishna had no need for Arjuna to be a great warrior, so Krishna took away all his abilities. So therefore, a devotee understands that whatever greatness was Arjuna's was by the mercy of Krishna, because he was a surrendered soul, because he was Krishna's friend. So Arjuna's only glory was his devotion. In fact, for a devotee, there is nothing else worth anything except devotion.
Jesus Christ's life, in the Last Supper, he gives them the wine, I suppose. As he says, it's my blood. So what is the significance of that whole thing? I do not understand. First he gives the bread and he says you will live eternal life, and then he gives the wine and says it's my bread.
It's the Jewish custom on Passover to take little wine and break bread. Passover means it's a long story, but it's the highest holiday amongst the Jews. And there's a supper for Passover. So, Jesus was saying that this is the new covenant between God and man. Huh? Which means that he was as the representative of God, to accept him is to accept God. And this Last Supper was, Jesus was ceremonializing the inner movement of the heart to accept him. You accept this bread as my body, and you accept this wine as my blood. What does blood mean? That means he died for you. He shed his blood for you. Are you willing to accept that? A Christian must accept that. And the ceremonial, of course, you have to accept it in your heart, but the ceremonial expression of that acceptance is to take one sip of that wine, which is his blood. And to take a morsel of that bread, unleavened bread, as his body.
So you all have eternal life if you eat it.
Huh?
He said all will have eternal life if you eat this bread.
Yes, that means accepting his life, accepting his mercy, accepting him as the representative of God. That's what it means. It doesn't mean just eating bread. The ritual is only a means to express something within. Simply by eating the bread, you do not attain eternal life. But if you accept that, if you eat that bread in that spirit, then you will attain eternal life. If you drink that wine in that spirit.
In this today's age, today's time, a person should offer the bread to Jesus Christ and then accept it. The wine also. In the church, they do that?
In the church, they do it. In the Catholic Church, unless you're a priest, you're not allowed to do that. Nobody except the priest is allowed to perform that ceremony.
It is said that a pure devotee never leaves the world unless he sees any other pure devotee carrying on the mission. Is that true?
He will do whatever God wants him to do. He does not act independent. If God wants him to leave, he will leave anytime.
But then it said that God always keeps pure devotees on earth.
That's for God to decide. It's not for the pure devotee to decide. The pure devotee is simply surrender to the will of God.
I remember there is a problem with Christianity that there are no pure devotees in Christianity.
The system of Christianity was a disciple succession. Peter was the first guru. Jesus said he would build on the rock of Peter the house of Christianity. And the idea of the Pope is supposed to be the disciple representative of Peter, who was the first guru appointed by Jesus. Now, of course, because the popes became very corrupt at one time, people lost faith in the church, and that's where the Protestant denominations. Protestant means Protestant. They protested against the Catholic Church because they considered the Pope to be a political person rather than a representative of Peter. So they started their own churches. But the need of guru is always essential, a living guru. Without a living guru, there's so many denominations of Christianity and so many opinions of what Christ meant. There's almost as many, or perhaps even more, opinions of what Bhagavad Gita teaches. How many different gurus are there with a different interpretation of Gita? Therefore, Prabhupada said, you must read Bhagavad Gita as it is. As it is means as it has been preserved through disciple succession. Otherwise, the real spirit of the Gita is lost. You cannot understand the true spirit of the Gita without a bona fide spiritual master. It's not possible. And that holds true with all scriptures. Even in the Vedas, it is said that the essence of the Vedas can never, ever, ever be understood unless it is revealed to you by a pure devotee.
Is there a shloka mentioning this?
In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, talking about Madhavendra Puri, he's describing this also. And in the Vedas there are so many slokas. Tadvijnanartham sugurum eva avigacche. This is from the Mundaka Upanishad. It said, if you want to understand the Vedas, abhigacchate means it is absolutely essential you must have a guru. Third guru parvadyeta jidyasu sreya uttamam. Bhagavatam says if you want to understand the knowledge of the Vedas, you must humbly hear from a spiritual master. And Krishna in the Gita says, Tadvidi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnanina svata darshana. If you want to learn the truth, you must approach a spiritual master, inquire submissively and render service to him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto because he has seen the truth. So throughout the Vedic literatures, this is very important. And also by the example of God himself, Krishna accepted Guru, Rama accepted Guru, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted Guru. Why? Do they need Guru? Just to teach us? They wanted to teach us by their example. That however great you are, without Guru you cannot understand the truth. Krishna studied the Vedas under Sandipani Muni. Huh? Just to show us by his example.
So, as a guru, topic from Guru has come, could you explain the meaning of initiation in short? Everybody will be ready.
What does it mean to initiate something?
Beginning.
What does initiate mean?
To start something.
To start. So many people think that initiation is the goal. People think once I get initiated, then I have attained a great position. But actually, when you accept initiation, that's when you begin your spiritual life. Not the end, it's the beginning. Before that, you're just preparing yourself to begin. Huh? Some people say that means everything I do before initiation is useless. No, you have to prepare yourself to begin. Just like when an athlete goes to a race, when they pull the trigger, the race begins. Right? It's not that the race ends, that's the beginning of the race. But he has to do all training to prepare himself before he goes to that race. So is that preparing work? The preparing work directly has nothing to do with the race. But indirectly, it's essential. Because he cannot begin properly unless he prepares and trains himself correct. So therefore, one must first, in the association of devotees, train oneself to qualify himself to begin spiritual life. Huh? And then upon initiation, the beginning is when we make formal, confirmed vows to the Lord and to the spiritual master. It's very serious. We're making vows. The external vows is that we must attentively chant 16 rounds every day. We must follow the four regulative principles. But that's not the spirit of initiation. Those are just the most preliminary qualifications. But from within one's heart, one is making a lifelong commitment that I am accepting this person as the representative of God in my life. And I will never leave him, I will never betray him, I will always follow him and serve him. That is the vow that is taken on initiation. It's a vow of your loyalty, of your commitment, and of your conviction that you will follow the spiritual master as God's representative throughout your life. And to break a vow to God is a very serious thing. So we should be very serious about initiation. And at the same time, the spiritual master is taking an even more severe vow. He's taking the vow that I will come back to this world, birth after birth after birth, whatever it takes to bring this child back to Godhead. I will accept all his karma, upon my own head. And I will, like a father, nurse this child back to Krishna. So at the time of initiation, the guru and the disciple make eternal vows. Now, that exchange of vows is absolutely essential for spiritual advancement beyond a certain level. You can make spiritual advancements to a certain point on your own, but then to progress beyond that, you must be willing to accept these vows, accept initiation. In other words, you have to commit yourself before God. So it should be done very sincerely. It shouldn't just be taken that, oh yes, just like Prabhupada would often say, do not accept the guru as a fashion. Some people, they accept the guru as like a fashion. But yes, I have my guru. And I have my picture of my guru on the wall, just like I have my nice vase of flowers on the wall. And I also have so many nice decorations in the house. Well, this is another one of my decorations. This is my guru. Guru is not a fashion. Guru is a very serious relationship of commitment. But it is necessary for one who is sincere. But the real initiation is not the formal ceremony, it's the heart. You can sit at the fire sacrifice and put the grains in the fire and put the banana in the fire and externally with your mouth say the vows, but you may not be initiated if your heart is not confirming what you are externally performing with your body. Huh? Therefore, the real initiation is in the heart. But the expression of that must be shown through the acceptance of the formal ceremony. Huh? It's like that.
So, if the disciple, after taking initiation, suppose starts breaking the laws, So starts taking intoxication or starts eating meat, or doesn't follow the instructions, then is that true that to that degree he is not a disciple of the Guru Maharaj and the Guru is not obliged to take him back to Maharaj?
The Guru is still obliged. Every time the disciple sins, that karma has to go upon the Guru. But at the same time, Krishna will give a reaction to the disciple to teach him a lesson too. So they both have to suffer. Huh?
Even chanting also.
We're talking about sinful activities. The guru suffers and the disciple suffers, both. The karma has to come to the guru also, but Krishna will also, for committing such an offense to the guru, Krishna will smash that disciple. Huh? Just like one time at New Vrindavan, there was one devotee, and actually he was breaking the principles. He was an initiated disciple. And he asked Prabhupada, I was sitting right next to Prabhupada when this was very, nobody who was sitting there will ever forget this. It was so, it had such an impact in our hearts. The devotee said to Prabhupada, what if after taking initiation his disciple falls down? And Prabhupada became like a lion. He spoke with a very deep, thunderous voice. He said, what is this nonsense? What is this rascaldom? Fall down. He said, there is no question of falling down after initiation. There is no question of it. He said, you have given your promise before the deities, before the guru, before the assembled Vaishnavas, before the sacred fire. He said, how can you ever break such a promise? He said, no gentleman will ever break such a promise. There is no question of falling down. Of course, this devotee was already falling down. He felt very embarrassed. And the rest of us, just our hearts were shaking upon hearing Prabhupada's words. Prabhupada took it very serious. And many of us realized how we didn't even know what taking things seriously was until we heard Prabhupada speak. Huh? That means they haven't understood Prabhupada's level of the expectation of how, of the sincerity that a disciple should have. This is Prabhupada's view of how serious initiation is. That means we haven't understood that. Therefore, we're still falling down. Huh? So therefore, if you fall down, you have to, just like a child, you have to get back up again. You have to keep trying. But there will be a reaction. When you break a vow before God, you can expect there's going to be a reaction.
Guru is also taking all that. He's going to look up to him. He's going to make us relax. So he's going to show me a way. May not be serious. Because Guru is going to look up to him.
God helps those who help themselves. He's looking after you by showing you the way, but he can't take you the way. He can only show you the way. You have to do it yourself. You have to hold on to his lotus feet. He can take you back to Godhead, but you have to hold on to his lotus feet. If you let, he cannot hold on for you. You have to hold on for yourself. But if you hold on, he will take you back to Godhead. Huh? But if you let go, there's nothing he can do.
So explaining the initiation is not important, it should be from the heart.
It must be from the heart. It must be from the heart. But the external manifestation is important. Because if something is in your heart, you have to externally manifest it, otherwise it's useless. Like many Christians say, it is not by works, but it is by faith. But then St. Paul said, it is not by, that faith without works is dead. If it's actually in your heart, why won't you make the vow? If you won't make the vow, that means it's not in your heart. Right? So they are both important.
Even after knowing the four religious principles we are supposed to follow, and even if I know that I'm supposed to have a spiritual master, why do I do not follow the principles, like, before getting initiated? I know it's very important that I should follow the four principles, and I know that I should have a spiritual master. Why I still don't follow the principles? Maybe chanting, or maybe
why it is difficult is not the question. The question is why we do not do it. Difficult or not difficult, that is not our concern. Our concern is it must be done. Huh? Is it difficult to raise your child? Yes?
Yes, no, but I still grumble.
Huh?
It's difficult for me to raise him, but I grumble about it. I don't want to do it.
But do you do it?
You have to do it.
So you have to change your arms. You don't have to do it. Many mothers do not do it. Right? Similarly, many disciples do not chant their rounds. What is the difference? That means some mothers are useless and some disciples are useless. A good mother is a mother, whether it's difficult or not, makes no difference. She does it. A good disciple, whether it's difficult or not, he does it. And a useless mother is when it's difficult, she just lets the child do whatever it wants. And a useless disciple, when it's difficult, he does whatever he wants. It is a question of responsibility. Srila Prabhupada said, to the degree you accept responsibility, to that degree you make spiritual advancement.
Huh? He also mentioned about four principles also. Intoxication, sex,
hmm. What is the question?
Same question.
It's a question of love. First of all, do you eat anything that you do not offer to your guru? Everything must be offered. Otherwise, you're eating sin. This is in Gita. Jagya shishta shinashyantam mucchante sarvakil vishay bhunjite etvam apa yepa chantyat makarana. Is eating only sin? Huh? Vegetarian food that is not offered to God is sin. Meat is worse sin. Sins have different gradations. Just like stealing from a rich man is a sin, but killing the rich man is a bigger sin. Right? But they're both sin. It's a lesser sin, but it's also sinful. The only food that is not sinful is food that is offered to Krishna. In offer to Guru. Correct? Now, do you want... Now, what do you offer to Krishna and Guru? What you like or what they like? Huh? The spiritual master in Krishna says, do not ever give me onions or garlic. So you have a choice. Either do not offer it and eat only sin and pollute your consciousness, or offer it and say, Krishna, I don't care whether you like it or not, I like it. Huh? What kind of mentality is that? That means you're eating not, you're not eating prasad, you're eating food. Right? The devotee only wants prasad, he does not want food. The animals eat food. Human beings are meant to eat prasad. So, if it causes pain to your guru to offer him onion and garlic, why do you want to do that to him? Huh? If it displeases Krishna, why do you want to do that to him? These are foods in the mode of ignorance. These are tamaguna foods. They're vegetarian, but they're in tamaguna. And we only offer of Krishna what is in the mode of goodness, sattvaguna. So if it's absolutely beyond your control, that that's the only food there possibly is, then the guru will accept it. He won't like it, but he'll accept it. Simply so that you could go on living. Right? But if there's a choice, and you choose this, then it is not correct. You should do the best you can. Hmm? if you can get out of the party, that is best. Come to the temple instead. But if you cannot get out of the party, then why cannot you explain to them that my religious training is that I do not take these foods? Is there something without these foods? Huh? There must be something without those foods. We don't have to take everything. Huh? What? But if it's too impossible, then you should just be very humble and beg forgiveness of your spiritual master and like that. In other words, if it's very difficult, very impossible, then you just have to beg the forgiveness of your spiritual master. But you should not enjoy it. You should take it as an austerity. Right? But as far as possible, you should choose that which is without. I remember I was at one time traveling in South India with one devotee. And this devotee, there was nothing to eat, so he would take us, and we went to this temple, and they were serving sambar and rice, and the sambar had all onions in it. So he said, "This is all there is, so you should just take it." I said, "But there's onions in it." Because we didn't have any prasad for a whole day. So he said, "Well, you just take the onions out." So I said, "All right." So I took all the onions out. It was about half the dal was onion, or half the sambar was onions. It was a full bowl, and by the time I took the onions out, it was half bowl. So then my friend, he took all the onions and put it in his sambar. All the onions that I took out and put it in his. I said, "What are you doing? Why, I'm taking it out and you're putting it in." He said, "What to do? It's time and circumstance." So this idea of time and circumstance can be taken advantage of. You have to be very honest. Sometimes according to time and circumstance, we have to do things that are not according to the strict principles. But we shouldn't unnecessarily go beyond what is necessary in this regard. Huh? God has given you intelligence, you should use it.
I went to the person and I informed him actually. But I don't know whether it was right or wrong.
What you have to do in those circumstances is you have to pray to Krishna. "In this situation, Krishna, how can I best serve you?" And if you honestly choose what you believe is the best way you could serve Krishna, then that is the correct way. Huh? If you're thinking, ah, very nice, I do not have to chant now. And that is wrong. But if you're thinking, I wish I could chant, but this is a very important service I must render, I will have to chant later, then that is correct. So your every act should be motivated by how I can best serve, how I can best serve my guru now. First thing is you should situate yourself in such a way that there's as few temptations as possible. Huh? You should not, it's hard enough to avoid the temptations that come of their own accord rather than inviting more. You should avoid putting yourself in a situation where there's unnecessary temptations. That means you should associate with saintly persons. Just like if you're trying to give up drinking, you shouldn't sit and meet your friends in the liquor store, right? If you're trying to be a vegetarian, you don't go into a hotel where they serve meat. If you're trying to give up drugs, you don't go to parties where everyone's smoking drugs or taking drugs, right? So the first gesture of your sincerity is that you, as far as possible, according to your power, you avoid exposing yourself to those temptations. Now in the line of your duty, if the temptations come beyond your control, then you have to be very strict in your sadhana when you're not under those temptations. In other words, if you're very strictly chanting the holy names when you're at home, if you're very strictly worshipping the deity, if you're associating with devotees and hearing their words with an attentive and receptive heart, this will give you spiritual strength. And that spiritual strength will give you the power to withstand the temptations and tolerate them when they come before you. You see, it is like a war with Maya. Maya is constantly throwing her weapons, and those weapons are in the form of temptations to defeat us. Correct? It's like in the Battle of Kurukshetra, they were fighting with arrows. So Maya's arrow is temptations. It's like Cupid. Cupid is pictured, Kamadev, with his bow and arrow. And that arrow is his weapon. And what is the weapon? Lust, material attachment, material attraction, temptation. Right? So this is the weapon of Maya. She's constantly shooting the arrows of material temptations at us. Now before going into the battlefield, you have to train. Just like in India, you have an army. Do they just draft people and immediately send them to the battlefield? First they give them 6 months to a year in training where they teach them how to shoot their guns, how to discipline themselves under this treacherous conditions of a battle, right? They train them in physical fitness. They give them strength. Then they go into the battlefield. So our training camp is every morning when we're chanting the holy names, every morning when we're worshipping the deities, when we're reading the scriptures, we're getting spiritual strength, spiritual depth. Every evening when we're associating with devotees as far as possible, we're hearing from them. We're strengthening our spiritual principles in life. And then when we go out into the field of our work, when the temptations come, we will be strong enough to tolerate the temptations. So first of all, you must prepare through sadhana, through spiritual discipline. And second of all, you have to avoid unnecessary temptations. And ultimately, when the temptations come, you have to cry out for Krishna to save you. Huh? You have to cry out for the mercy of your Guru Maharaj, please save me. Please give me the strength. And Krishna will give you the strength. For the soul, it's painful. It's pleasing to the senses, but it's painful to the soul. And tapasya is painful to the senses, but pleasing to the soul. Huh? Why is it painful to the soul? Because it separates the soul from God. Sense gratification separates our consciousness from Krishna. And there is nothing more painful to the soul than separation from Krishna. Correct? That is why we worship the deity. That is why we decorate the deity so nicely. We decorate the deity so nicely, we come to the temple so that our eyes can find pleasure in seeing the beauty of God. And when we learn how to find pleasure in seeing the beauty of God, then gradually the forms of beauty in this world become very insignificant. So this is a test of our sincerity, that we only listen to those things which purify our consciousness. We only look at those things beyond what is necessary that purify our consciousness. Huh? Krishna says in the third chapter of Gita, one must control the lower self with the higher self. The lower self is the mind and the senses, and the higher self is your intelligence. So by hearing, you gain intelligence. What helps my spiritual life and what hurts my spiritual life, right? Now, the mind and senses are always telling you one thing, and your intelligence is always telling you something else. So the question is, are you going to listen to your mind and senses, or are you going to act according to your intelligence? You must control your lower self with your higher self. By hearing, we understand what is good to look at, what is not good to look at. What is good to eat, what is not good to eat. What is good to hear, what is not good to hear. This is our intelligence. And our mind and senses are telling us usually the opposite. Huh? So we are torn between our intelligence and our mind and our senses. This is the mind. The mind is caught between the intelligence and the senses. When the mind chooses to follow the senses, the mind becomes our worst enemy. When the mind chooses to follow the intelligence, the mind becomes our best friend. Huh? This is why yoga means to control the mind. Yoga means not to let the mind go toward the senses, but to let the mind go toward the intelligence. Now the intelligence is telling us which sense objects we should be attracted to and which we should avoid. Huh? So if we follow the dictations of the intelligence, which is coming from Guru and Sadhu, then our mind is our best friend. Then we are always engaging the senses in Krishna's service. The same mind, the same senses, which is now the cause of bondage, when it follows the direction of our good intelligence coming from Guru and engages in Krishna's service, the same mind and senses engaging in the same types of activities becomes purifying. Huh? It's like you like to eat. If you eat the right thing, you become purified. If you eat the wrong thing, you become degraded. If you hear the right thing, you become purified. If you hear the wrong thing, you become putrefied. If you look at the right thing, you become purified. If you look at the wrong thing, you become pure. You become degraded. So bhakti means to be active, to be dynamic, but always in Krishna's service, with the guidelines of the intelligence directing us. We never become the servant of the senses. We become the servant of Guru and Krishna.
When I'm chanting, when I reach 8 rounds, I feel I'm fatigued. That is enough for me.
But it's not enough.
That is enough for me.
But is it enough for Krishna? Your son, probably at a certain point, your wife says, it's enough for me. But does that mean she just throws him out of the house? It's her duty. Right? Why are you thinking in terms of enough for you? The question is, are you doing it for you or for Krishna? Is it enough for Krishna? You have patience, right? As a doctor, sometimes it's enough, I don't want to deal with this person anymore. Does that mean you just tell him to get out of your office in the middle of an operation? This is enough. Huh? Do you do that when you're treating a patient? Are you doing it for you or for him?
That is, I'm aware of the situation.
Well, you should be aware of this situation too. If Krishna wants you to chant 16 rounds, 8 rounds is not enough for Krishna. It might be enough for you, but it's not enough for Krishna. So then the question is, am I doing it for me or am I doing it for Krishna? Am I serving what I want or am I serving what Guru and Krishna wants? Whose servant am I? Am I my own servant or am I Krishna's servant? My mind is telling me it's enough, but Krishna is telling me to do more. So am I the servant of my mind or am I the servant of Krishna? Which one? Huh? So we should become Krishna's servant. Surrender means it's not enough until we please Krishna. Hari. Hari.
What others are doing for the Guru.
if we are thinking to glorify the others, then that is very good. We're thinking, oh, he's doing such wonderful service, I just want to hear more and more about his glories. And that is very nice. But if we're competing with them, with the desire that this competition will help us both do more service, and that is also very good, because you're actually encouraging that person as well as encouraging yourself. But if we're trying to outdo a person for our own prestigious position, then that is due to envy. And that should be overcome by becoming the servant of that devotee.
But when you hate a person, at least you say you should go and serve him. But more of the negative things are revealed to you first. You know, then, why should I do this? This person is so and so like this. But that is more than the humility which you can tell him by serving.
You should know that the defects are in you, not in him. We only see the faults in others when we are honeycombed with thousands and thousands of faults within ourselves. It's what we hate the most within ourselves that we can't tolerate seeing in another. We don't want to admit it's in me, but we're very anxious to point it out in another. Huh? A person who has a pure heart sees the good in everyone, but a person who has bad within him, he sees that bad within outside. He's not willing to admit that it's in him, but he's very anxious to admit it's in somebody else. It's like when you point your finger at another, how many are pointed toward you? Huh? That means you should, before finding one fault with another, you should find three faults in yourself. Huh? If you do like that, you'll probably not find too many faults in others anymore. If we understand how many faults in our own heart, we'll be kept fully engaged. We won't have time to find faults in others. We should rectify our own problems. Huh?
There's a little for you there, even with the
It should begin with the devotees. We should not find faults with the karmis. We should be like a doctor. We're willing to diagnose their problems, but it's not in a fault-finding way. It's in a constructive way. We are not desiring to find fault in anyone or anything. If we do point out faults, it's only for that person's betterment. So when we point out faults and karmis, it's to educate ourselves of what we must be careful to avoid. Right? Therefore we have to point out faults in them, otherwise we will be like them. We have to know what they're doing wrong and why. But we're not doing it to make ourselves look better than them. We're not doing it to discredit them. We're simply like a doctor diagnosing a disease for the benefit of those who want to prevent having that disease, and also for the cure of those persons who have the disease. So a devotee's criticisms are on the level of a diagnosis. And they should never be on the level of fault finding, ever, ever. To anyone.
Can a guru speak through a non-devotee or a karmi?
if the Nandavati or the Kami speak the same thing the Guru speaks, then you should accept it. It is said you can accept gold even from a filthy place. Gold is gold, whether you find it in a garbage bin or whether you find it in a gold mine. Right? Gold is always gold. So if a Kami comes up to you and says you should chant Hare Krishna, you should accept, yes, he's correct. My guru is speaking through him. Bilva Mangala Thakur, a prostitute, told him to surrender to Krishna. And on the basis of that direction, he accepted it. My guru is speaking through her. And he surrendered to Krishna. Huh? So whoever tells you to surrender to Krishna, it's good. His spiritual life was reawakened by the words of a prostitute who told him to surrender to Krishna. Okay. Thank you.